Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. We have a very important show today. We open with some coverage from Tuesday night's rally in El Cajon among Iraqi Christians seeking to stop genocide in Iraq. And then we'll have an exclusive interview with Mark Arabo about a new resolution passed by the United Nations to protect Iraq's Christians. We'll have the latest top news and weather. And then on Bookshelf, Raina Menashe will be interviewing Steve Willard, the San Diego historian and author of several books on the San Diego Police Department. And if you thought the San Diego Police had some issues today, just wait till you hear some of the stories he has to tell from the police department's very colorful past. And finally, Leon Thompson and Rebecca Williamson will bring you this week's Destination East County, telling you about some top festivals, events, and attractions across the region this week, as well as some previews of some exciting events coming up next week in East County. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ. On Tuesday, hundreds of Iraqi Christian Chaldeans held a march for peace through the streets of El Cajon to draw global attention to the genocide occurring in Iraq, chanting, "Save Iraqi Christians, save Iraq, save humanity." Passerbys in the community showed support, honking their horns and giving the thumbs up as they drove by, much to the cheers of the crowd. Former State Senator Wadi Dedda, the first Iraqi American to hold public office, also gave an impassioned speech with a strong message for the Obama administration, urging the president to take action to save the lives of Iraqi Christians, for America to open our doors and bring them here.
400,000. Not one, not two, not a thousand. 400,000 Christians committed no crime, broke no law, cheated nobody out of anything. But why? Because they believe in our Lord Jesus Christ who created us. May God bless them. May God protect them. With your prayers, I hope and pray that someday, we will be gathered here to welcome those brothers and sisters.
Mark Arabo with the Neighborhood Market Association, who has emerged as a national leader speaking out to save Iraqi Christians, also spoke to the crowd and delivered some good news after his recent meetings at the United Nations.
Last week, myself and Bishop Jumor, our His Excellency Bishop Sirhead, and Bishop Francis from the East, and delegates from Michigan, we went to the United Nations. We went to 12 different member states of the UN and asked them to offer these folks a home. Offer them a chance to live. Offer them a chance for life. And what we got last week, we were able to get the United Nations to send $600 million in humanitarian aid. $600 million for our people that are dying. $600 million to give hope. What we also did last week, we were able to get France and Australia and now Sweden to open their doors. France, Australia, and Sweden are offering a home for our brothers and sisters. generation, there's a defining moment for every community. This is our moment. This is our time to help as much as we can, work as much as we can, write letters to the White House, to the UN, to your members of Congress, and talk to every single person you can. I challenge every single one of you here tonight. Every one of you should talk to 5 people tonight about this Christian genocide. Talk to 5 people tomorrow about how they could help. Talk to 5 people the day after tomorrow to see what they could do. The world community needs to act. And we will not stop our journey until we save every single person that's stranded in Iraq. Because just like they're your brothers there, they're our brothers. And this bloodshed for our community, for my community, for your community, has to stop. We need to offer them a home. And we're going to do everything we can.
And next up, we have an exclusive interview with Mark Arabo. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. Today, my very special guest is Mark Arabo, the head of the Neighborhood Market Association. Many of you know him as locally, and he's also become a national spokesman for the Chaldean American community. And he's accomplishing some amazing things to bring help to the people in Iraq that are being persecuted by the ISIS terrorists over there. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the latest news that you are hearing from the United Nations? I understand that you've just gotten a resolution passed and you're working on a second one. Tell us about it.
Yes. Well, I want to thank the world community. I really want to thank your radio station. You know, we sounded this alarm 9 weeks ago on your station, calling out this full-blown genocide, crimes against humanity, and these are stateless people. If you think about what's happened to Iraq, in 2003, before the war, we had 1.4 million Christians and minorities. Today, we have less than 400,000. So 1 million have left over the past 11 years, and they're living all around diaspora. The 400,000 that remain, if they're not being killed or massacred because they're not converting, they're being killed because of starvation.
Yeah, and the stories are they just seem to get worse and worse and more horrifying. Right. I know that we're hearing now that with some of the Yazidis, another religious minority over there, that they've been throwing them into mass graves when they're still alive. That's the latest that we've heard from there. And they've actually been selling some of the young girls into the sex trade.
I can tell you, the world hasn't seen atrocities like this for generations.
It reminds me of the Nazis. It's horrible.
This is definitely a Christian Holocaust is in our midst. We're doing everything we can. You know, 8 weeks ago, we went to Washington, D.C. We started a resolution with Congressman Juan Vargas, House Resolution 663, which became 683.
And passed.
Which passed unanimously.
Which is amazing in this Congress to get anything through unanimously. Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a grassroots movement that was really God's work. We're just the instruments of it. Then we took our case to the White House. We met at the White House 3 weeks ago with Ben Rhodes and 10 other folks that are from the Security Council for the president. And we were asking for humanitarian aid and airstrikes. A week later, President Obama gave it to us. And then last week, myself and the Bishop Jammu from the Western United States, Bishop Francis from the Eastern United States, and delegates from Michigan, Ade Arabo, Sam Yonu, and Joe Kassab, we all went to the United Nations. We met with 12 different member states. We met with the Iraqi ambassador. We met with the UN Security Council members. We also met with the Office of Prevention of Genocide. We met with the UN Secretary General.
Very good.
Met with Turkey. So we had monumental meetings, and a big thanks goes to Afaf Kanja. She actually is the spokesperson for the UN president of the assembly, and she happens to be Chaldean. So the stars aligned, and we took our efforts there, and we had the UN, after we left, passed a resolution, 2170, which basically says any member state, any individual or company in the world that's part of the UN that funds ISIS will be sanctioned, their bank accounts will be frozen, What they also did, which was huge, is they issued a level 3 emergency, which is the highest level the United Nations could issue. Mm. And what that did is it released $600 million in humanitarian aid. We need to make sure that these folks, these children and families, they get aid immediately because they're dying because they don't have water, they don't have clothes, they don't have diapers.
The U.S. has also made some humanitarian aid drops as well, I understand. And speaking of the airstrikes, we're hearing that they're having some positive effect, that it's beginning to repel the ISIS forces in some places. Notably, yesterday in the news, we heard that a dam near Mosul that had been seized by the ISIS forces is now back under control of the Iraqi government, we're hearing.
Right. And that was a huge win because the Mosul Dam strategically is such an important area.
Yeah, I've heard that it could flood two major cities and even send floodwaters into Baghdad were it to burst or were it to be destroyed intentionally by the terrorists. There could be thousands of lives lost almost in the blink of an eye there.
Right. And so with the Kurdish government and the new Iraqi government working together to get that dam back,
strategically, there were Kurdish forces in there too, we should say.
It was a big win. But what we're doing in Washington and in New York with the UN, we're advocating not just for Iraqi Christians, but Yazidis, minorities.
Mm-hmm. Really, are there any
everyone.
Jewish minorities left in Iraq, by the way?
Not that we know of.
Okay.
And one thing that the Iraqi ambassador kept telling us in our meeting was, you know, we lost the Jewish community years ago in Iraq. We don't want to lose the Christian community.
So people are finally waking up now that it's other minorities.
And what we've said is nobody wants to leave Iraq. Nobody would want to leave their homeland. But when your house is burning down and no one's there to put out the fire and you're dying, you have to leave.
Yeah, they're telling people, again, if you haven't heard this, listeners, that they're forcing people to convert to Islam or die, be killed by the sword, so to speak, literally. So I understand that you're now pushing for another resolution in the United Nations that would authorize airlifts, a mass evacuation of these people that are being persecuted by ISIS. Again, Christians, but not only Christians, it would also include the Yazidis and any other minorities that are being persecuted by the terrorists. What are the chances of that being approved, are you hearing?
Well, I could tell you that since the beginning of our journey to fight against this genocide and fight for humanity, everything we've done, the deck has been stacked against us. And when we did a House resolution, people said you have a 1% chance of passing it. We passed it unanimously.
Wow.
We went to the White House. They said, you're not going to be able to get them to move. We were able to get them to move. At the United Nations, they said it's too big. It's 193 countries. How can you make them agree to one thing? We were able to get them to agree.
What was the vote?
At the UN, I believe it was overwhelmingly or unanimous. And right now, the next biggest thing that I'm working on and the community is working on, because this is really our journey, not just of Chaldeans or Christians, but of all humanity. I'm receiving hundreds of phone calls a day from everyday Americans saying, we're there with you. We pray for you. We support you.
And ISIS, if it's not stopped, it could go beyond Iraq. Already they've gone from Syria into Iraq, and who knows how far this could go.
And now they've went into Lebanon.
Wow.
And so Lebanon is, and keep in mind, the leader of ISIS was in U.S. custody in 2005. We released him in a prisoner exchange. And when we released him, he said, I'll see you in New York. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ISIS knows no boundaries.
And so they could be here. There could be cells of them here already, for all we know.
We have to do what we can as a world community, as a country, to protect our homeland, to protect our nation. The number one thing the next president, whether it be Clinton or Rubio, whoever it is, the number one thing they need to worry about is a strong foreign policy. Because if you have a strong foreign policy, you could protect your national security. Right now, what we're working on to help the 400,000 people have a chance to live is we're asking the White House and the world community to offer them a home. We were able to get France now is accepting asylum. Australia, we were able to get Australia to offer asylum.
To offer asylum. So France, Australia, has the U.S. agreed yet?
So we're also, we met with Samantha Powers, and what we're asking for the U.S. to do is to do what President Ford did. In the 70s, President Ford airlifted 150,000 Vietnamese refugees.
That's right.
In 1980, President Reagan offered a home for thousands of Cuban refugees. President Obama, right now, has, and the country has, a moral obligation to act. Because this, what's happening now in Iraq, is a bitter consequence of a 2003 war that we should have never done. Right. We lost 5,000 of our sons and daughters in a war.
And that was launched by President Bush, the prior president.
Right. So mm-hmm. President Bush launched a war that should never have happened. But now President Obama is our president. And as President Truman says, the buck stops here. Mm-hmm. And we're appealing to him and asking for him to do executive order to airlift these folks out of there.
Now, East County and San Diego are already home to a very large Chaldean American community, Iraqi American community. Some 40,000 or so are here in the region. I think, 25,000 of them right here in El Cajon and East County, unincorporated areas of East County. Is it likely, I'm assuming, that if there is an airlift, that some of those people would be brought here? Do you have an assessment of how many more people our own region might absorb? And if not here, where else?
So we're talking to the State Department to see where they would end up in if we do end up airlifting them. The State Department would have to do that designation. They're the ones that picked El Cajon. Mm-hmm. What I could tell you is hundreds of emails and phone calls that I'm receiving every day from everyday Americans are saying these refugees could stay at our home. Wow. We'll make a room for them. America is the light of the world, and the citizens of it mm-hmm. are the most big-hearted citizens you could think of.
I really think that the media coverage is making a difference. As you noted, I think we were the first to sit down with you and do an interview to cover the rallies that you held and, you know, others in the Iraqi community held, the mm-hmm. Kurdish rallies and things as well. I was actually a little bit surprised when the Union Tribune ran a poll about the airstrikes, very, you know, conservative politically, but they ran a poll asking how many people would support that, and 85% said yes. Given that we just got out of a war and there's certainly been a lot of loss of American lives there, I thought that was quite telling that enough people seemed to understand the consequences and what was going on over there, that this is a genocide, mm-hmm. you know, that ISIS really is a threat to the whole world if they're not stopped, that they would support that, even coming on the heels of a very, you know, long and bitter war.
Yeah, I could tell you that of all the media interviews I've done, from we did CNN, we did MSNBC, we did Hannity on Fox, mm-hmm. we've done your radio show, that the response has been overwhelmingly the same, in the sense that
very good.
We need to save the Iraqi minorities, the Christians. This is a war against humanity. And one thing we're asking for is for the world's human conscience to wake up. Because regardless of what religion you are or what walk of life you are, when there is a full-blown genocide happening, the world needs to act. Mm-hmm. And right now, we have a solution where we could save 400,000 lives right now without putting one more boot on the ground.
Right, and it should be noted that President Obama has made very clear that he does not intend to send in any more ground troops. This will be limited to airstrikes, humanitarian aid, and perhaps now the airlift if your effort is successful. Now, the other thing we should talk about is there has been a change in the Iraqi government over there. Prime Minister Maliki has stepped down. Another in his same party, his same religious group, has taken the helm there and is working, I understand, to form a more inclusive government, hopefully. Do you think there is hope for that? I mean, is the only way ISIS can be stopped, in your view, militarily? Or do you believe that, diplomacy or some kind of inclusion could help stem this violence as well? What is the answer? Or is it a multifold solution over there?
It definitely is a multifold solution. One thing that is crucial to the success of Iraq in the region is an inclusive government, where it's Shiites, Kurds, Sunnis, Christians alike. When we met with the Iraqi ambassador last week in New York, he asked us, if you have someone in Iraq that's a Christian that you want in the government, please let us know. Mm-hmm. But one thing we do know now, because there's a short-term answer and a long-term approach. The short-term approach is 400,000 people are dying every day. They don't have the basic necessities and they're refusing to convert. We need to save their lives. We need to offer them aid. We need to offer them a home. Long term, we need to rework the Iraqi government to make sure it is an inclusive one. Make sure all these factions are united under one Iraq. And then and only then you can rid of outside terrorist groups. So it's a multifold approach, but right now that's so dire and time is against us is
save lives.
Saving lives. Yeah. You know, 2 days ago, a mother called me, or 3 days ago, and she said her daughter was murdered. She was stabbed 14 times.
Horrifying.
And every time I answer the phone, my heart breaks because the sound I'm hearing on the other side is so devastating and so heartbreaking. And
I can't imagine the pain of going through that. It's just absolutely chilling and heartbreaking.
So one thing I would ask for everyone is we need your prayers, regardless of who you believe in or if you believe or not. We need you to pray for us to whatever God you believe in, but we need your prayers and we need your support.
Now, we're recording this on Tuesday. It'll be aired on Wednesday, but tonight, Tuesday night, there is a march and a rally, a peace march planned through El Cajon. Can you give us a little background on that, Mark?
Well, I want to commend Stephen Nisu and Alan Thwaney. They really spearheaded the efforts for this specific rally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a peace walk from St. Michael's Church in El Cajon to downtown El Cajon to raise awareness and to let the people know, like the mother that called me 3 days ago, that she's not in this alone.
Yeah.
That we're all in it together for our fight for humanity. And the power of social media is so important. You know, when we started this efforts 8 weeks ago, we embraced social media and with everyone's tweets and likes and shares, they have been able to move this discussion to Congress, to the White House.
Yeah, you had a rally, a prayer vigil here a couple of weeks ago, and there was, what, about 2,000 people or so that turned out for that?
We had thousands of people show up. And
what message is it that you hope to send to the world, and what is it that our listeners can do to help?
They could pray for us. They could follow our journey on minorityhf.org. The main message right now is we're asking for the world's human conscience to wake up. Human beings with a human heart, we need your help for humanity. 400,000 lives, innocent lives, are at stake right now. They're dying every hour. They don't have the basic necessities. And everything you could do, whether it be a tweet, a share on Facebook, or a like, or a letter to the president, a letter to the UN, everything matters. We could move major legislation, major change, only if we're all united, regardless of who you believe in or where you come from.
Mm-hmm.
We need your help right now to end this genocide. We need the world community to come together to end this genocide. We're asking for the world's human conscience to wake up. And regardless of where you're from or who you believe, we need your help, we need your voice, we need your support right now to save 400,000 innocent lives.
I can't think of a more important action that people can take than to stand up and speak out to help save these 400,000, nearly half a million lives that are imminently at risk over there in Iraq.
I want everyday Americans to know that their emails to us mean the world. And when they're saying, we pray for you, we're there with you, we're writing to the UN, writing to the president. Those actions make a difference. You know, you build a house brick by brick.
Yeah.
And their emails are those bricks. We need everyone to come together right now. And this is a time for human beings with human hearts to step before humanity.
We certainly wish you all the success, Mark.
Thank you.
I can't imagine a more important cause that people can get behind than trying to save nearly a half a million lives that are imminently at stake. And this is a movement that started right here in East County and is having a big effect to help people around the world, largely thanks to the leadership of yourself. If people want to get involved and they want to help and they want to add their voice, where can they get more information and how can they reach you, Mark? And again, we're speaking with Mark Arable, a leader in the Chaldean American community here about the genocide in Iraq.
Thank you. They could follow our journey on minorityhf.org. Or MarkArable.com. I'm also on Facebook under Mark Arable and also Twitter.
And it's spelled A-R-A-B-O.
Yeah, M-A-R-K-A-R-A-B-O. Right now, we as a community need everyone's help. And every little thing, whether it be a tweet, a share, a like, a letter, everything matters.
Yeah.
We need to end this genocide. And we're going to keep going until we do.
Well, our hearts certainly go out to you and everyone in the Iraqi American community, Mark. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
For joining us on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
The San Diego City Council approved raising the minimum wage to $11.50 an hour, overriding a mayoral veto. The council voted 6-2 for the minimum wage increase. Republican Mayor Kevin Falconer vetoed the measure earlier this month, claiming it was bad economic policy. Some opponents have talked about mounting a ballot measure campaign to overturn the wage measure if it is enacted. Both sides in the debate cite economic growth in making their case. Supporters say the bill would add $1,400 to the annual average pay of employees who are now at or slightly above minimum wage, pumping an additional $260 million per year into the local economy for low-income residents to spend on food, shelter, and clothing. Opponents say it would place an undue burden on businesses still struggling to rebound from California's economic slump, forcing many companies to lay off workers and pass on their higher labor costs to consumers. Opponents must collect 34,000 signatures over the next month to put the increase on hold until a referendum in June 2016. If opponents fail to gather enough signatures, the hourly minimum wage will gradually increase from $9 currently to $11.50 an hour in 2017. San Diego is the latest city to try to lift wages. San Francisco voters will decide in November whether to raise that city's minimum wage to $15 an hour. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
This is Ed Barena with the weather report. If you're planning to be outdoors this week, keep an eye on the sky. Subtropical moisture will flow into the region, bringing a chance of thunderstorms and rain showers Thursday in the mountains and deserts. Remember that lightning can strike even from many miles away, so the National Weather Service advises, when thunder roars, go indoors.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Steve Willard, seasoned member of the San Diego Police Department and author of three historical books, San Diego Police, Case Files, America's Finest, A History of San Diego City Law Enforcement, and Images of America, San Diego Police Department. My guest, who serves as VP of the San Diego Police Historical Association, is a valued consultant to museums and other historical police books. He's also been featured on several TV shows, including CBS's 48 Hours, the BBC documentary Past Lives, and the A&E show New Detectives. Welcome, Steve. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
Let's start with your fascinating professional history. I know that you joined the SDPD in 1985, working patrol.
Yes.
And now you serve at the San Diego Family Justice Center, and they help victims of domestic violence. What has been your most memorable police work to date, and how does it inspire you to write books?
Well, the one thing I noticed about when I came on the police department is it's very diverse in history. At the time, I was only 96 years old, so there's a lot of talk about the 100th anniversary coming up. And I remember thinking, where can I find more information about this? And quite frankly, there's nothing written down. I remember, kind of just stumbling along. We had the 100-year gala and thinking, wow, I wish somebody would really start putting this all together. It never really occurred to me I could be the one to do it. It just, I always saw a need there. I sort of fell into writing later, and I'll mm-hmm. talk about that in a little bit. But you asked about memorable cases. Some of the bigger cases I've been a part of, and I was just one part of a very, much larger team. The Danielle Van Dam investigation of all of them sticks in my mind the most. Mm-hmm. I was a tip coordinator for the task force, and there's about 40 people working on that. And that was the most grueling because the stakes were so high, and ultimately a little girl was dead. So that one has always stuck with me. But I remember when I came on, listening to people talk about the McDonald's massacre, which had occurred a year before, PSA, Brenda Spencer, stuff like that. This was not just gigantic to San Diego. It was international stuff. And it was those events that other police departments started looking to SDPD about how do we handle mass school shootings like Brenda mm-hmm. Spencer? How do we handle mass murder like what happened in San Ysidro? At the time, it was the worst massacre in the history of the United States. PSA, when it crashed back in 1979, was the worst aviation disaster in America. So within 6 years, we had some monumental events happen here in San Diego. So even though I wasn't around at the time, it kind of really made me realize that I was something much bigger than myself, or a part of something much bigger than myself.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say you enjoy most in police work, or what is your forte?
I think it would be just kind of having a ringside seat to life. You get to see a lot of stuff that the average person doesn't get to see. Mm-hmm. And that can be both in good and bad ways.
Sure.
You get to see a lot of human tragedy. And quite frankly, there's some stuff that I probably could live without. But there's been other stuff where I've seen things, I've been able to help people. And I think some of those gratifying is when you do something for somebody and to you, it's just doing your job and you run into the person later and they'll tell you, hey, you don't remember me, but you saved my life. One of the stranger cases I was involved in was back about 1995. I went to, at the time, I was a crime scene investigator in the robbery unit, and I went to a call of shots fired at an attempted bank robbery. So when I got there, what had happened is a guy walked into what he thought was a bank, fired a round off in the ceiling, and yelled, "Everybody get down, this is a robbery." And the people in the building yelled, "We're not a bank, we're a real estate office."
Oh, no.
Well, the guy, of course, that really threw his plans, so he ran out the back door into the alley, slipped and fell against a car, and he propped himself up, and he took off running down the street. Later, when I got there, I collected the shell casing that he had left behind, and we lifted his palm print off the car. Ultimately, that shell casing was linked to a gun that was used to kill a police captain up in Central California. And they had no idea who did it at the time. And through the palm print that we lift off the car, they were able to link him to the gun, linked him to the gun to the murder, and ultimately the person wound up on death row. So that was a pretty serious case. And it's one of those things that on day one, they always tell you, you never know what small thing you can do that could ultimately wind up as a major case. And usually they would use the example of, something would go to the Supreme Court. Well, in this case, it didn't go to the Supreme Court, but pretty heady stakes nonetheless.
Wow, it's fascinating.
So
you never know what to expect.
No, absolutely not. Every day's different.
Your most recent book, I know it was co-authored with fellow SDPD member Ed Laval, and it teaches us about the history of San Diego through the case files. And I know you've told us a couple of those files right now. Is there anything else, an older case, that comes to mind?
There's been a few. Back in the early 1960s, there's a couple down in Ocean Beach, newlyweds, sitting on a pier. Somebody walked up and just killed them for no apparent reason, and the case has never been solved. And I remember meeting a couple of retired homicide detectives that even though they were retired, they're still trying to work the case.
Really? That's wonderful.
And one of them had said, he goes, "I know who did it. I'll just never be able to prove it." And unfortunately, the people who were killed and their families are not going to get justice out of that. And those, I think, probably for anybody in this profession is the most frustrating, you know, where you know somebody did something, you just can't prove it. Right. And the family's just kind of left wondering why and, you know, is there going to be justice for them? And sometimes the answer might be no. So that one definitely stuck in my mind. The other one was back in 1965. There was a shootout downtown called the Hublone Shootout back in May of 65. And the building was recently a Starbucks. It just now closed. I don't know if it's closed permanently or if it's doing a remodel. But what had happened is an individual walked into a pawn shop and asked to see a rifle. When he took the rifle, he loaded it, and then he shot and killed the manager, and then the gunfight was on with law enforcement outside. Ultimately, 800 rounds were shot back and forth between the police and the gunman. It was completely out of control. We have film of it at the museum, and unfortunately, off-duty officers who saw us on TV were going down emptying their guns into the building and leaving. It was that chaotic. Wow. Ultimately, a man named Sergeant Alan Brown went into the building. Originally, he went in with two officers, and one officer's wounded had to back out. But Alan went into the building, and all the windows had been blown out. It was dark. The sprinkler systems were on, so it was, you know, almost literally like it was raining inside. He goes up the flight of stairs looking for the gunman, and as he gets to the top of the stairs, he hears a click, click, click behind him. It was the gunman who had loaded the gun with the wrong ammunition. And so Alan turned around, shot the guy several times, and ended the shootout. I'll never forget when I met him back in the 80s. He was very humble about the whole thing. I said, you know, you're a genuine hero. He said, well, I'm really no hero. I was just, you know, happened to be a guy in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he goes, I was a World War II veteran. Somebody had to take that guy out, so I took him out. His son was Judge Frank Brown, who served on the Superior Court for about 20 years as a judge downtown. But Alan is one of the most humble men you'd ever meet in your life. And till the day he died, he always downplayed the incident. You know, again, World War II, he's an officer in World War II. He had worked in a ball bearing factory, was draft exempt because he had an important job, and he went and joined up anyway. So he's just one of those kind of guys. So he was absolutely very dedicated. So he was one of those guys that, you know, as I looked at the profession, I said, there's some remarkable stories to tell, mm-hmm. and there's some remarkable people. And unfortunately, their humility is causing them to die with these stories. So that was one of the reasons I started writing the books.
So you're telling it for them.
Exactly. You know, and a lot of people like to, you know, commend me for being an author. And I just tell them, I'm just a guy with a pen. It's everybody else's story
right.
that I'm able to tell for them.
Well, that's modest as well. But
well, but again, they're the ones getting shot at.
Right. Well, let's take the story a little older. I know your photo book, Images of America, dates to 1889, when we had out-of-control crime and violence on every corner and Tombstone's Wyatt Earp and, you know, running the Marshall's gambling interests. Give us a brief description of some of the photos from that world, what San Diego was like back then, and why you think that's important to remember as well.
Well, if I could, I'd like going back even further in that to around 1850 when San Diego was first founded, because when we first became an American city, we were a small, dusty village. But we had an interesting guy come into town. His name was Agustin Harzisi, and there's no need to try to spell it. Even he spelled it several different ways. But what made him interesting was he's a Hungarian count. Uh-huh. And when he came to San Diego, he had brought his whole family. He's one of the richest immigrants to the United States at the time. And when he landed on the eastern seaboard and moved west, he established several cities, including Sauk City, Wisconsin, which is still there. He established his shipping routes. He's a very innovative man. But the reason he landed in San Diego is he wanted to create the wine industry. He was a connoisseur of fine wine. Oh. And it just wasn't quite what he was looking for. And he ultimately wound up moving up north to Northern California, where he did, in fact, establish the California wine industry and created Zinfandel. And his winery, the Buena Vista Winery, is still around today. But while he was in San Diego, he did a couple of remarkable things. One of them was he appointed a deputy as his sidekick to work for him by the name of Richard Freeman, or we suppose the name was probably pronounced Richard Freeman, because Richard Freeman was black. He was a former slave. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, you have a former slave 13 years before the Emancipation Proclamation as a peace officer in California. So that was a remarkable achievement. The other thing that he did that was quite interesting was when San Diego was first founded, they had $10,000 in their treasury. And his salary as marshal was $1,000 per year. So pretty good salary.
That's amazing.
Big salary. Well, it gets even better because his father is on the city council and his brother-in-law was a city attorney. So the city decided they needed to build a jail. they were going to become a civilized town, because prior to that, they would chain people to a log, or they would hang them, or they had to shoot them. So they decided they needed somewhere to incarcerate people. So they put out, believe it or not, a request for proposals in 1850, and several people responded. Robert Israel, who later was one of the keepers of Point Loma Lighthouse, him and his brother responded with a bid to build a jail for $3,000, and Agaston submitted one to build a jail for $5,000. Somehow he got the contract. Now, if you're doing the math, $10,000 in the treasury, $5,000 for the jail, $1,000 for salary. Now he's 60% of the salary, or the treasury, is going straight to him. He builds a jail out of mud, brick, and straw, and then the first time it rained, it melted. So he goes back before the council, said, I need more money. They give him another $2,000. Now, again, you're $8,000 out of $10,000. The first person he arrests is a young man who's the younger brother of the town mayor. The town mayor at the time was Joshua Bean. Joshua Bean was later killed up in Los Angeles County, maybe by gamblers. But his younger brother went on to fame as the hanging Judge Roy Bean of Langtree, Texas. So anyways, he books Judge Roy Bean into jail. He's 25 years old. He's in there about 4 hours, digs his way off the spoon, and takes off to Los Angeles, and ultimately becomes part of the Los Angeles Rangers. And there's a number of books about him as well. That bankrupted the city of San Diego. So we actually declared bankruptcy.
That's not new.
It is not new. So I remember when I was hearing, you know, San Diego talking about maybe having to declare bankruptcy, I was scouring all the records I could possibly find to see if there's been any Americans ever had to declare, American city, it's ever had to declare bankruptcy twice, because we might have been the first. But he ultimately, again, founded the California wine industry. He was the first assayer of the San Francisco Mint along the West Coast. And he, in typical larger-than-life fashion, most people might die of a heart attack or just pass away in their sleep. He is eaten by a crocodile in Nicaragua trying to cross a raging river. So if you're going to go big.
Right.
But to get to where San Diego was in 1889, you have to understand, in 1880, San Diego had 3,000 people. In 1889, they had 40,000. So we had a real estate boom.
Wow.
Now, in 1893, we had a real estate bust, and we were down to about 6,000. So it really went stratospheric and then fell back almost to where it was. Part of the reason was the railroad. The railroad brought all kinds of people, and, of course, the steam lines as well. But you're right, Wyatt Earp was indeed in town. He made friends with Marshal Joe Coyne, ran a lot of his gambling interests, officiated racing, served as a referee for boxing matches and things. Now, what's interesting is when Wyatt Earp came to town in 1887, he lived here for about 3 or 4 years, but he was a fugitive from Tombstone, Arizona. There was a warrant issued for murder for what happened at the OK Corral. So that part, I'm not sure if a guy blew into town today, he would have the same experience that Wyatt Earp had back then. But when the city marshals, and they wore badges that said San Diego Police on there, but they were tasked with other duties as well, tax collection and things like that.
Really? They did tax collection?
They did tax collection. That's how the city made their money. Okay. And there was 25 of them, and their appointments were based a lot on who you knew. Party affiliation did, in fact, matter. And finally, the voters had enough. They said, we need to reinvent government here. So in 1889, they passed what's called the Freeholders Charter. And on May 9th, 1889, the police department was officially formed, what we now know as the San Diego Police Department, even though there have been prior agencies known as the San Diego Police as well. So with that, they appointed Marshal Joe Coyne as the city's first police chief, and the city marshals of 25 were cut down to 12. So we joke about being understaffed now. It's true, and we were understaffed back then as well. So we've been doing more with less probably since day one.
And just as a side note, how many members of the police department do we have now?
We have right around 1,900 sworn police officers, and then about 500 civilian staff. So we've quite a bit larger than what we once were.
It must really help you as an author to have such a good memory to remember all these details.
I was always a history geek growing up, so that was helpful. You know, and that's part of the reason why I kind of fell into the police history. I'd like to know where I worked. But one of the more fascinating stories as well occurred back in the 1930s. In Los Angeles in the 1930s, they were a very, very corrupt city. The chief of police was James Edgar Davis. And a couple interesting San Diego connections with James Edgar Davis. For those who've ever watched Southland, the TV series, in the very beginning, you see a police officer in a hat with a pistol pointed right at the camera. That's James Edgar Davis. He was also portrayed in the movie The Changeling with Angelina Jolie as kind of an uncaring police chief when the woman is trying to locate her son who came up missing. Anyways, James Gurd Davis liked to brag he was the world's right-hand left-handed pistol shot of the world, best around. He came to San Diego for an international pistol competition that our rangemaster had set up, and he did not leave with that title. Our rangemaster beat him and took the title. But the other part of it was, is back in the 30s, LA was very corrupt, and you had the chief who was involved in a lot of gambling, everything. If it was illegal, the chief and the mayor were involved in it. Well, a former San Diego police chief who had actually come from Los Angeles, served here for only 90 days before he got fired for enforcing liquor laws downtown, went back up to Los Angeles and hooked up with a man named Clifford Clinton, who runs Clinton's Cafes in downtown Los Angeles. The family does even today. Mm-hmm. Well, they started a crusade to rid Los Angeles of corruption, and they started doing investigations. And our chief, Harry Raymond, in 1937, made an announcement that he had enough evidence to bring down the house, and he was going to present it. So one morning, Harry Raymond gets in his car, and his car explodes with him in it, but he lived. And he actually testified against the Los Angeles Police Department, resulting in James Edgar Davis being removed from office. Mayor Frank Shaw was recalled, and 10 members of the LAPD top brass went to prison. So we like to say San Diego PD brought Los Angeles to its knees.
Oh, no. So, well, that's a fascinating
another forgotten
history.
Story, yeah.
Yeah, very colorful.
Indeed.
Let's change the subject a little bit. I know that your next book is a fictional account of a San Diego murder from 1941. I know you don't want to give too much information about an upcoming novel, but give us a teaser, if you would, about the case and what made you choose that one over the alternatives.
Well, I'd always been impressed with fiction. Number one, it requires less research, but more of imagination, of course. But the other one was in 1927, there was a detective who was killed. It's a true story. A detective was killed in the line of duty in Balboa Park, and the case was never solved. And what's always been kind of fascinating about that is there was a policewoman with him at the time. Mm-hmm. And what was happening was there was, and to this day, there's still is, you know, after hours, people sometimes use dark areas as a lover's lane. And that's what was going on. So a bandit was going up to cars, shining a light in the window, making a demand for money, and then taking off. There was nobody ever hurt up until the policeman and the policewoman went out into the park to try to catch this guy. And when they set themselves up as bait, they pull under a tree. They're there for a few minutes, and a light comes on. And the policewoman later said it almost looked as though the detective recognized the gunman, and the gunman opened fire and killed him. So the question's always been, why did he kill the detective and never hurt anybody else? Was it somebody that he knew? Was somebody he worked with? Was somebody he had arrested? The question had never been answered. So I decided I want to take that story and give it some legs. And so that's kind of the basis of it. I bumped it from 1927 to 1941 for a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to have my fictional murder occur on the very early morning hours of December 7th, 1941. Because right as after this detective is killed, the announcement that Pearl Harbor has been attacked. Right. And this really did happen. That knocked the city, well, for that matter, all of America really on its ear.
Sure.
But in San Diego, all the officers sent scrambling back to work. We had no idea if a Japanese invasion was coming.
Right.
So it takes the real life elements of what happened that morning. Mm-hmm. And this really throws that investigation for a loop. So I took some real life characters, detectives of that era who I had met when they were very old men, and unfortunately have since passed away. But I put them working the case and using modern forensics. The case goes cold. And then using modern forensics, it ultimately gets solved in 2006. Through techniques that were not around back then.
Right.
So it literally jumps for 65 years from when it started to when it ends. The hard part really was the authenticity of it, because police work is very different back then than it is today. So trying to have people who walked in that world fit into what we are doing today was an interesting challenge, but it was a lot of fun too. So ultimately, the book kind of takes a life on its own. I like to think it has a few surprises in there as well. I throw in a couple of elements from the 1850s that ultimately come back even today and help one of the characters out quite a bit. So,
what's the name of the book, and when will we see it?
Well, the name of the book is No Statutes for Murder, and that's based on the premise of law that there is no statute of limitations for homicide. It'll come out as soon as I can find a publisher to buy it. I've been sending it around, query letters, had some interest, but you know, it apparently is not good enough to sell yet, or the timing isn't right, one of the two. But I've never been one to give up. Interestingly enough, for writers, if you write in one genre, that's great. Like for like history, you know, I could write history books all day long. And with history, it either is or it isn't. And you either have an audience or you don't. But for novels, of course, everyone wants to be a novelist. But the other part is, it's like, well, what other novels have you written? Well, everybody has to have a first one. So I think once I can get over the first one, I'll be okay.
Well, it sounds fascinating. I'm sure you'll do well with it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, we've got to come to a close now. We could talk about this all day, but our time is up. For more information on Steve Willard and his work, please visit www.sdpolicemuseum.com/steve-vp.html. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts,
Leon Thompson
and Rebecca Williamson, bringing you the best, the most exciting
festivals, events, and attractions
each week. Stargazers, wine lovers, and music fans will all find plenty to savor in East County this week. Plus, in this week's edition of Destination East County, we'll have a preview of coming attractions so you can mark your calendars, including a pair of Indian powwows and the season opener for the Aztec football team.
If you enjoy stargazing, here's a heavenly event for you this weekend. The annual Julian Starfest will be held from August 21st through August 24th at Mangini Winery in Julian. This includes a free public stargazing party on Saturday night. You can take a star tour of the heavens using the many telescopes set up in the viewing area. Experts with telescopes will be on hand. Bring a flashlight to stroll from the parking area to this event, which is sponsored by the San Diego Astronomy Association and the Julian community. For more information, visit julianstarfest.com.
Mercury Street Blues will provide live music Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. at San Pasquale Winery's back room in La Mesa's downtown village. The band plays jazz, blues, folk, and rock. There is no cover charge, and guests may purchase wine by the glass, cheese, and crackers or dessert. Seating is on a first-come, first-served basis. For details, visit sanpasqualewinery.com.
You're invited to celebrate Stoney's Kids' 23rd anniversary and founder Stoney Stone's 89th birthday to the benefit of Children's Causes in East County. The party will be held on August 21st at the Sequan Golf and Tennis Resort in El Cajon. Dinner, a cocktail hour, live and silent auction, prize drawings, and of course, birthday cake will all be part of the festivities. For tickets and information, visit stoneyskids.info.
Family night ice skating continues on Wednesday nights this week and next. It's all part of Hot Croc Nights at the Salvation Army Croc Center at 6845 University Avenue, just one block west of La Mesa. You can lace up your skates with the kids to stay cool. For details, visit croccenter.org.
Swazdell Winery in Ramona is hosting a free concert series on Saturday afternoons. This Saturday, August 23rd, Chini and Combreros will perform a blend of world beats and rhythms from 1 to 4 p.m. Their music promises to take you on a journey from the deserts of the Southwest to the isles of the Mediterranean. Robert Chini, a drummer, keyboard player, and bass player, has played with England Dan and John Ford Coley. Jorge Cabmeros is a talented Latin guitarist who has worked with Al Mackey of Earth, Wind, and Fire and other notable artists. For details, visit Swazdell Winery.
There's still time to take in some end-of-the-summer concerts and car shows. El Cajon's classic cruise nights continue on Wednesday evenings from 5 to 8 p.m. in downtown El Cajon. La Mesa's downtown village hosts its last two Back to the 50s car shows this Wednesday and next from 5 to 8 p.m. Santee's summer concerts take place on Thursday night starting at 5:30 at the Trolley Square Center. Plus, on Friday nights, El Cajon invites you to enjoy dinner and a concert. The music starts at 6 p.m. in Promenade Park. This week's concert will be a tribute to Santana, followed by reggae music next Friday. Find details on your calendar at eastcountymagazine.org for a full schedule of all these community events. And now for a preview of coming attractions.
The 44th Annual Barona Powwow will take place from Friday, August 29th through Sunday, August 31st at the baseball field on the Barona Reservation. The event features competitions among Native American dancers from across the nation, competing in events such as gourd dancing and fancy dance. You'll also find Native American arts and crafts, food, and more. This event is free and open to the public. For more information, Google Barona Powwow.
The Aztec football team's season opener takes place on Sunday, August 30th at Qualcomm Stadium when the San Diego State team squares off against Northern Arizona University. If you want to cheer on the team and get tickets, you can visit GoAztecs.com.
The Sequan Band of Kumeyaay Nation will host its 25th annual powwow on September 5th through 7th at the Sequan Reservation in El Cajon. A powwow is a celebration or time for people to join together, sing, dance, renew old friendships, and make new ones. Traditionally, powwows also welcome the beginning of life in springtime and provided a place for young people to meet and court. Today, dancers and singers from tribes across the nation come to compete for prize money as well as to keep up relationships. Only registered contestants may participate in the dancing contests, but everyone can take part when an intertribal dance is announced, visitors included. Dancers are in the center of the circle, with audience forming a larger circle around them to bring together the community and culture. There are no spectators at powwow. Sequan's website states, everyone is a participant.
That's all for this week. You'll find the details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like to add to our calendar, or if you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County show on KNSJ, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County. See you around, East County.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.